fellowship welcome. Marie.
My name is Mari, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm very grateful to be here, and I am definitely most grateful to be sober. I would like to thank Charles for calling and asking me to participate in this 29th annual fellowship on the beach at Myrtle Beach. I'd like to thank his wife, Anne, for being a gracious hostess, all the committee members and Jay, and all of the people here who have made this a wonderful weekend. This is a very different conference to... I go to a lot of conferences, and there's usually a lot of meetings, and you don't get a time to meet with people. But I really like how they do this here, and having it on the beach is very beautiful. And being with Ken, who I've spoken with before, I believe, and a few years ago, and meeting some new speakers here. And I want to thank you. It's a great experience. And also, the people here, I'm the only person here that doesn't have an accent. And people here have taken great advantage of me. A man came up and said to me, "What is that?" I said, "It's Mari, M-A-R-I. He said, "That sounds like Hawaiian chicken." I said, "It's Gaelic." He says, "It's what, honey?" Somebody else came and said to me, "Have you had grits?" I said, "No, I never had grits." He said, "Well, just have one." "And see if you like it." So I went into the restaurant and I was looking for one grit. The way you would look for one potato chip or something. But I realized they were taking advantage of me. There's one thing that I was struck with. Bill Wilson, when he said that we don't have any churches, we don't own any buildings, but he said that when we all gather together to have a meeting, then what it is the cathedral of the Spirit. He says, when we all come into a room, the floor is paved by the 12 steps. And when you look at the walls, that is the traditions that are enclosing us. And then there is the spire of service that hopefully will reach ever towards God. And that is what this fellowship of the Spirit has been to me today. And this here now is the cathedral of the Spirit. And it's a wonderful feeling. This magical thing that happens when a group of alcoholics get together. I will tell you what I used to be like, what happened, and what I am like today. Please keep an open mind. I do not speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. Some people think they speak for Alcoholics Anonymous, but nobody does. Also, please keep an open mind when I talk about my God. I talk about the God of my understanding. I believe there's only one God. But I talk about how I understand my God. And I also remember that Dr. Silkworth spoke about many different personalities that have this illness of alcoholism. And I will just tell you about my particular brand. I was born in Glasgow, Scotland, and my parents were Irish. And I used to think that's why I was nuts. Being Irish, born in Scotland, was a great dilemma. Half of me wanted to drink all the time, and the other half didn't want to pay for it. I was brought up by my granny and my grandfather. My grandfather was a coal miner, and I came from a long family of coal miners on my mother's family side. And my father went to sea, so I was brought up with my granny and my grandfather. and they had 11 children. And so there was a lot of adults around me. And my old grandfather was my hero. Because my father was at sea, he was my hero. I used to call him my pop daddy. And he was very bright, and he taught me how to read when I was 4 years old. But you see, every Friday and Saturday night, my old pop daddy would go to the pub. He'd come home from the pits, the mines, he'd get washed, and he'd go to the pub. And every Friday and Saturday night, there would be the only war that there ever was in my home. My old grandfather would come staggering down the street from one pavement to the other drunk. And all the neighbors were behind their curtains laughing at my hero. And my grandmother, who was an untreated Al-Anon, she would be behind the curtain with a rolling pin and a rosary. The two staples of the Irish household. And my old grandfather, every Sunday morning when we were walking up to church, he'd say to me, "I won't do it again, Princess. I won't do it again." But sure, every Friday and Saturday night, he'd be doing it again. And I said to myself, "I will not drink. I will never have my family standing behind the curtain with weapons waiting for me." And I hated the liquor. You see, my old grandfather and me, we had a bond that he didn't have with anybody else in the family, and I didn't. And that is, he could produce magic. He used to make magic for me. You see, me, I was kind of strange when I was born. I felt like a leprechaun in a Presbyterian church. I was always looking for magic, and there wasn't any. I had something that a lot of alcoholics have. You will never hear Al-Anon give us any credit for it when they're living with us drinking. But that is, I had a high IQ. And the only thing a high IQ enabled me to do is I never completed anything I've ever started. Ever. I got bored very quickly. And because of this high IQ, I was sent to a convent to be educated by the psychopathic nuns. I used to think they messed me up. But you see, I came to know that the nuns were trying to teach me to have character. You see, I did not know that character was something you did when nobody's looking. I didn't know that. You see, I was always a character. But I never had any. The only character development I have ever had is through working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got thrown out of that convent at 15 because I was very angry. I was a rebel. You see, my last name is Irish, and I was then a Catholic. And if you're an Irish Catholic growing up in Scotland, you're a second-class citizen. And if you go down to England, you're a third-class citizen. And I had a lot of anger about that. And Glasgow, Scotland is kind of like Belfast East. On St. Patrick's Day, we beat up the Protestants. And on the Orange Walk Day, the Protestants beat us up. And it's just a custom, you know. So my family, it didn't bother them, but it bothered me because I was born with a resentment. I was born with an anger, and I was always looking for something to have an issue with. And I just got into a lot of trouble. And I started running with street gangs when I was 15. And I did things that my family would never want to know I had done. In fact, I did some things that I hoped I would go to my grave without telling anybody because of my rage and my anger. And I hadn't had a drink yet. And I decided after a couple of years, that I wanted to be a lady. I wanted to change. And I went into nursing, and I got bored with nursing, and eventually I went down to London, England. And in London, England, I joined British Airways, which was then BOAC. And I was going to have them teach me how to be a lady. You see, I wanted to elevate myself from the coal mining place and the coal mining background and the working class background. I didn't want it anymore. I had done my stint of running with the gangs and all the things that were rebel things, and now I wanted to be somebody else. And I knew there was something wrong with me, but I didn't know what it was. Because I was restless, irritable, and discontent. I used to have panic attacks, and I'd have palpitations, and I was never at ease in crowds, and I always felt inferior, but I had a grandiose exterior, and I thought, I'm going to go down to British Airways to these English people, and I'm going to be as good as they are. And when I went down to England, they used to say to me, why don't you try and speak the Queen's English? And I won't tell you what I told them. But eventually I was able to adjust my accent. I joined British Airways. They taught me how to talk, how to walk, how to hold my knife and fork, and how to be a lady. And on the outside, I was looking good. But inside, I was beginning to fall apart because I had done many things that I thought made me a very bad person. And I thought, no matter what I look like on the outside, I know what I'm like on the inside. And I've thrown away the God of my understanding. So I did the next best thing to having a drink that I could think of, and I got married. And I may have been crazy, but I wasn't stupid. I married a rich man. And I went to live in Kingston, Jamaica. And his family were old rum people. And they were old rum family people. And after a year in Jamaica, my first child was born. And I loved that child with every fiber of my being. But just after he was born, I thought I was going insane. And somebody said, have a drink. And I drank it. And for the first time in my life, my skin fit. For the first time in my life, I felt the same as you. I had been walking around all my life feeling different, feeling less than, feeling inferior, feeling as if I came from another planet. I used to look at people and say, why can't I have that way of moving around that seems so natural and is so difficult for me? That's what drinking... You see, I believe that when I drank that first drink, I got a change of personality. That's what it did for me. A change of personality. Because what is going to recover me from it eventually is another change of personality. So eventually AA will do for me what alcohol did for me immediately. And I loved it. It was like I was wrapped in a piece of velvet. And I immediately drank on a daily basis because it was that good. And I have an amazing tolerance. I could drink a lot. And I loved rum. It was marvelous. You know, you drink that and it's warm. And it goes all the way down to your toes. And it feels just right. I am a pure alcoholic. I am the first white alcoholic Rastafarian in the history of Jamaica. There was a group of people in Jamaica who had a religion called Rastafarian. And people in Jamaica treated me with respect because my husband came from the upper echelon in Jamaican society. They treated me like a white oddity, which I was. And they let me move around wherever I wanted. So I used to go and observe some of the people, and I'd go to some of these parties and they'd have these big baskets of sensimilia. Do you know what that is? Marijuana, ganja. And they used to say to me, Mary, come try a little ganja, man. Look how the liquor is making your eyes red. I said, I don't want nothing that's going to screw up my brain. I'll stick to liquor. Thank you. And I never took it. But you know, I saw then the difference to me between an alcoholic and a drug addict. There's a lot of conflict in Toronto right now because what treatment centers are doing is they're sending pure drug addicts to Alcoholics Anonymous. and telling them to say that they're also drug addicts. But they're not. As Bill Wilson said, there is no way of making a non-alcoholic drug addict into an AA member. We'll kill them. We will, because they can't identify. And they can't do anything for us because they can't do any 12-step or tell a pure drunk story, you know. But so what I saw then was when these people would have ganja, they would say, "I just want to mellow out, man." Have a little vision. That's not me. When I drink, I want to arrange things and move around. I don't want to lie down inert. I want to get active. And that was the difference I saw then. After about 4 years, my second son was born, and I must have crossed the line into being a chronic. If there ever is a line I crossed, I think I was a chronic alcoholic from the get-go. And I began to have the personality change, and I had my little boy, and I loved that child just as much, but I had maids and gardeners to look after him. And I loved the bottle more than anything. And I was becoming very obnoxious. And people in Jamaica would call me and say, "Mary, I'm having a party. Please don't come." And I am extremely sensitive. So I would go anyway. Because I have a British passport and I'll go anywhere. You know, you can't keep me out of anywhere. Like these Rastafarians used to say to me, "You're not black." I'd say, "I'm black Irish. I can go anywhere." My husband, he was a gentleman. He was a good man and he was a well-respected man, and he was becoming very ashamed by my behavior. And he called my mother. Now, my family, they have a certain type of insanity that is private, if you know what I mean. It's not the kind of insanity that disturbs anybody. You know, it's private. And, for example, I have an aunt, and she'll be sitting having a cup of tea. And all of a sudden, she freezes in time. And people will come in and say, "What happened to her?" They'll say, "She's just away. She'll soon be back." She can be like... So anyway, he called my mother and he said, "There's something seriously wrong with your daughter." My mother said, "There was always something wrong with her, dear." So he didn't get any help. You know, he didn't get any help. There was a singer who used to live across the road from me in Kingston, Jamaica. And his name was Bob Marley. He was a local traditional singer. He was a prophet, and he used to be very much in the political movement. He used to say, "You're running and you're running and you're running away, but you can't run away from yourself." And many years later, I was to read in our AA literature, where it said, "We keep trying to change people, places and things, but we never think about changing ourselves, because self, manifested in various forms, is the root of our problem." And how do you get rid of self? I was about to start on a geographic, hoping to find something that was within me. But I didn't know. And unfortunately, I took these two little boys, who were now 8 and 5, on a drunken odyssey. On a journey with alcohol when they never touched a drop. I divorced my husband, I left the island, I went to Scotland. A man I had known called me and said, "Let's get married, I'm a Canadian citizen." I thought, what a good idea. I'll go to Canada. And he took me to Canada and we ended up in Alberta, which is very cold. You have to drink a lot of rum in Alberta. I think it's sort of like Dakota. You know, it's very cold. Please keep an open mind. This man I married was a good man. He was a born-again Christian. He seemed to know that I needed some kind of a spiritual solution. He had me jumping for Jesus for a while. And I didn't drink for about 6 months. But then I did. And this man was, as I said, was a good man. The only thing is he didn't work. I had got a job immediately as a pharmaceutical rep because I had a great Valium deficiency. You see, what was happening to me was I was now shaking too much in the morning to even pick up my drink. And because I had some nursing training, I knew that I needed Valium. So I got a job as a pharmaceutical rep. And he said God would provide, you know, his side. And I used to say, I've never seen God's signature in a check, you know. I said, I think that you have to get out there. God helps those who help themselves. In the end, I sent him away. Because I came home one day and he was fighting with my two sons over a bowl of Fruit Loops. But you see, again, that's what happens to me too, you see. You see, before I knew anything about love, what love really is what would happen to me is I would fall in love. Him and me would be like Velcro. And then after about 6 months, thrill is gone. And I'm off looking for that ding-a-ling-a-ling someplace else. And that's how it was for me. Now I'm alone with these two little boys in Canada. They don't have anybody but me. And they would wake up sometimes in the morning and see me lying on the floor drunk. And my eldest son would get my youngest little boy ready for school and fix him a sandwich. And they would come home at night and find me lying on the ground. Sometimes I would drive with them in the back of the car and I'd be so drunk and they'd be screaming. I heard somebody say once that the person who wrote, "We will not regret the past, nor wish to close the door on it," couldn't have been a parent. That is the only thing in all of Alcoholics Anonymous literature. And I know Bill was not a parent, but it is a very difficult thing. The things my children see and have saw, no innocent child should ever see. And what happened eventually, I have something a lot of alcoholics have. It's called alcoholic telephonitis. I don't know if any of you have ever suffered from it. Alcoholic telephonitis is a phenomena that never attacks in the day. Alcoholic telephonitis usually approaches around midnight. When you're sitting alone with your jug and you want to call somebody and tell them how you've been screwed by the world. But you don't want to call anybody nearby because they might come. She's ahead of me up there. So what you do is you call other countries. You forget there's a time change. And when they pick up the phone, after you've woken them up, you pass out. And I have these two old aunts. They're virgin aunts. And they're very tribal. And they came to Calgary, Alberta. They put me in detox and told me I had early menopause. And that's called Irish rationalization. But you know, a wonderful thing happened to me when I was in detox in December 1979. In Calgary, Alberta, it was just me and five Native Canadians. And they would hold my soup to me and my coffee to me when I was shaking too much to hold it by myself. I got some idea of the fellowship of alcoholics, although I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. These Native Canadians told me that they drank because their spirit was broken. And I thought, my spirit, I know I'm a bad act. I know I've done a lot of things. I've taken advantage of a lot of people. But there's something inside of me that is soft. There's something inside of me that is broken. So I could identify with them. And you know, many, many years later, I was reading a Bill Wilson, Carl Jung correspondence. And Bill Wilson had written to Carl Jung in 1961, just before Carl Jung died. And Bill Wilson was telling him thank you for how much Carl Jung had done for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because it was Carl Jung who in 1931 told Roland Hazard that he was beyond human aid, that there was nothing medicine could do for him. And Roland Hazard had come back to the States, joined the Oxford group and told Ebby. And Ebby had gone to Bill Wilson. So when Jung got this letter from Bill, he wrote back and said, you know, I'm glad to know what happened to Roland. He said, I often wondered. He said, you see, at that time I couldn't really speak freely because I was being accused of many things. He said, but what I really believed is that an alcoholic is seeking on a low level for a thirst for a union with God. He said, the formula for the alcoholic is spiritus contra spiritum, which is Latin for spirit against spirit. And what happens? We give up spirit to find a spiritual program of action. The only solution, really, to the illness of alcoholism is it's contingent on our spiritual condition on a daily basis. So we take spirit, but we're drinking the wrong kind of spirit. And I thought about all that many years later. These were some hints and guesses that I was getting on the way. When I got out of detox, I thought I would go back to the Caribbean. You see, all I ever wanted was to have a little drinky-poo. That's all I wanted. And to sit under a banana tree and to make connivial, pleasant conversation. But that was long gone. And I took my little boys and I went back to Jamaica in December of 79. I thought their father will support me. He'll support the children. The children will have their father. And maybe, just maybe, I'll be able to get my dignity back and sober up. But I was too far gone. And in December of 79, my ex-husband took away my children and they were gone for 13 years. And Alcoholics Anonymous hasn't healed the crack in my heart. And my God hasn't healed the crack in my heart. Because you see, those little boys were everything to me. There is no greater pain. And you know this, those of you who have lost children. And God knows some of you have lost them to death. Or somebody you love. To wake up in the morning and know that you won't see that face again. What a terrible thing that is. And I had never abused my children. I never lifted my hand to them. I was just very irresponsible. So I didn't want to live anymore. And I had my first suicide attempt. And an old house in Kingston, Jamaica. I took 2 bottles of Valium and 151 proof rum. And I remember looking out. I had all the shutters up and there was just a little opening in the louvers, and outside it was bright and there was heliconia and thurium and doctor birds. It was beautiful, but inside it was dark and my soul was dying. And I said, if there is a God, will you please let me die, because I cannot live without my children. But somebody found me and they took me up to the hospital and they pumped out my stomach, and I was very angry. We are very hard, as they say in Jamaica, you're hard to dead. Alcoholics are hard to dead. People in Toronto that I work with in AA, they come and say to me, Mary, I know if I drank again, I'd be dead. I said, you wish. You wish. Some of us live forever drinking. You know? The psychiatrist, after they pumped out my stomach, he came to see me the next day. He told me something that was intellectually correct. It was very observant, and it was most definitely relevant to my condition. The psychiatrist said to me, "You mustn't do that anymore." I had an admonition. My worst remember when is coming out of an old rundown hotel in Kingston with my escort of the night before. If there's any tourists who were in Jamaica in 79, I'd like to make amends. As Charles said, Charles made amends to me for being in Jamaica. You see, alcoholism is the loneliest illness in the world. Old Scott Fitzgerald, the American author, he wrote that in the real dark night of the soul, it's always 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was always 3 o'clock in the morning for me. It seems to me as if the hand of that clock used to stick there and it wouldn't move. And I want somebody to go through the night with, not for any physical reason. I want someone to drink through the night with me and to listen to me when I talk about what I have lost. To share the terror, the bewilderment, the frustration and the despair. The pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that will come with the sunrise. The only thing is, the early morning comes and it's another stranger that the sun shines in on. And the loneliness is overwhelming. And I was walking out of this hotel and a car passed by with my 2 children in the back and their father and his new wife. I was to know much more shame and degradation, but that was the worst for me, for my soul. And I left the island to go and drink myself to death in Miami. I knew no one in Miami, and it is very hard to drink yourself to death. I got a little apartment. I would drink, pass out, they'd steal my furniture. I'd drink, pass out, they'd steal my clothes. They'd take that which I had to give, and that which I did not have to give. I ended up selling my blood for $20 a pint. And if you can't get where I got, think about it. I had never heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had destroyed every loving relationship in my life. I'd had a past even before I drank. I did not think there was a way ever to get back any sense of dignity. I had no idea of a God who would ever forgive me. I thought I was damned. And I just wanted something to take the pain away. I ended up living on Skid Row at the bottom of Lincoln Road on Miami Beach. My nickname down there was Ugly. I was so swollen. My feet, I wore size 10.5 flip-flops, which eventually had to be cut off, because they had dug into my feet. And I guess I was exactly where I was supposed to be. Sometimes I would scream. Sometimes I would see children and the pain would be overwhelming. I think there is no greater pain. But then I would be able to anesthetize my pain with alcohol. But you see, you can't stay drunk all day. You drink and you pass out and you come to. That's just how it is. And when I have moments of consciousness, I think in my mind's eye of everything I've ever done. And I can't bear it. I do not want consciousness. I want unconscious. When I was down there, my father died. And they were all looking for me and nobody knew where I was. Eventually, I panhandled off an old woman called Joyce, who used to live in Jamaica. She was an English woman, and she'd moved to Fort Lauderdale. And she contacted my family, and they came and got me, sobered me up, and I went back to Alberta. And this time, I met a man, fell in love. He was going to look after me. I had a mission. I wanted to go to Jamaica to see my children. I was going to get a job, and was going to shape up. And sometimes I would work for a few months. I would go to a psychiatric ward. I would get put on Nardol, Permate, Librium, Lithium, whatever I had to have to function. Antabuse. I'd work, save a little money, get on the plane in Edmonton, Alberta, and be drunk when it landed in Kingston, Jamaica. And my children would be brought to the airport. They'd see me staggering off the plane, and they'd be taken away. And I had to turn around and go back 5,000 miles. And how my children and me survived that. And that is the illness of alcoholism. I did not want to do that. I love my children. But I could not stop drinking. I was beyond human aid. I started going the way it said. I went in the mental institutions. They tried every possible form of medication on me to try and stop me from drinking. You know, I love being institutionalized. Because when I'm institutionalized, I'm safe from the greatest enemy I have, which is me. And you know who we are in the institutions. We've all got paper slippers and a lot of cigarettes. That's the neurotic alcoholics. And we just shuffle around the ward, zonked. You know, and they used to put me to sleep 22 hours a day, and I loved it. That's all I wanted to do was sleep. Oblivion, please. The last time I was taken there, I was taken by the police. I was in a lot of trouble. They kept me in there a long time. And when I got out, I would have to go to court because they wanted to put me away. And the psychiatrist called me. He said, I've written this to go to court with you. And he let me read it, and it had three diagnoses: chronic alcoholic, abnormal personality, and depressive. And I think that just about describes alcoholics. You know, depressive and abnormal personality, of course. It says in the big book, the thought that we are like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. You know, we're not going to be like other people. So I went to court, and the prosecuting attorney wanted to put me away, and the defense says, Your Honor, this woman has suffered tragic social circumstances. And I think that that's how it was. I was a tragic social circumstance. Born that way, you know. I just did not know how to exist within society until I came to AA. One night, I was sitting, and I was at that place that you know. The best way to describe it is between a rock and a hard place. And I was drinking myself sober. And that is a terrible place to be. Because what happened is your body is not functioning, and your head is full tilt, like a race course. And I had been to a few AA meetings when I was institutionalized, but I was always on Valium and Librium. I never understood anything. But something must have stuck. And I picked up the phone and I phoned AA. And a man called Stan came, who had 29 years sobriety in Edmonton, Alberta, at 3 in the morning. And Stan sat down and he told me his story. And when he finished, he said something to me. When I told him a bit of mine that nobody had ever said before, he said, I think you're one of us. And I wanted to be terminally unique. And I said, Stan, I know I'm an alkie, but I'm also nuts. I got a psychiatric report and I'm Irish. He said something that brought me in the door. He said, Mary, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is like 12 adjustable wrenches. They fit any nut that comes through the door. And those are words of wisdom. Words of wisdom. I had one slip. And I had about 4.5 months, but I couldn't find a God in my understanding. Or I couldn't surrender, or I didn't want people telling me what to do, or I was too arrogant. I don't know. But I had one slip. And the night of the 9th of August, 1984, some AA people came and they took me to a meeting. And I was in very bad shape. I was quite drunk. They tell me I was shaking so much, strangers were waving back at me, you know. And that night, a little gal called Linda, who got sober in Winnipeg and had moved to Alberta, a little gal called Linda spent the night with me. And the next day she said to me, "I'm going to leave, you know, because you're a loser. And I only stick with winners in Alcoholics Anonymous. But before I go, I'm going to ask you to kneel down and say the third step prayer." I said to her, "I don't kneel for nothing." And then something said, "Think of your children's eyes." And I knelt down and I held her hand and I repeated the third step prayer after her. And from that moment to this, I have had no desire for a drink. None. Two things could have happened. I had an inner surrender because I just had an inner surrender. It was time. Or it was some unmerited gift of grace from a loving God for an alcoholic who was destroying herself with this obsession and phenomena of craving. I do not know which one it was, but I have not wanted a drink. Now, does that mean I'm well? No? I wonder why. Of course not. As Bill Wilson said, getting sober is just the beginning. He says we are people with a lot of problems. I'm going to have to get down to the causes and conditions that made me drink in the first place. What I was a person who had a lot of personality defects, and I poured liquor on them. So when you take away the liquor, I still got a lot of personality defects. It's just that simple. And I get a program of action. And what happened to me is in Alberta, there was a lot of old-timers who were very good for me. They said, "Get a big book, get a sponsor, get active. If you don't go to meetings, you don't find out what happens to people that don't go to meetings." It took me a long time to understand that. And then sometimes, after about 3 months, one day they asked me to go out and buy the coffee. And I brought back the change. That may not sound like a big thing, but it was to me. And then they gave me the key to go and open up at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, shifters meeting. And I couldn't believe they would trust me to do that. And then eventually all the yellow went out my eyes. I had those white eyeballs that are really important. They really are important. That's not a joke. When you've got liver problems and your eyeballs are yellow, you want white eyeballs. You know, it's important. And then old Ernie used to come to me, and he was a great old timer. He says, "Mary, we usually say no relationships for a year, but for you it's two." Because you have a propensity for getting married. So there is my dry date, the 10th of August, 1984, and what a journey it's been, and there has been so many lessons. Just before I was, you know, when I was about 9 months, Bill Wilson was my higher power. That's all I could find a God in my own understanding. Because remember, I'd known a Catholic God. I had no idea of any other concept of God. And I could not get my head around this Catholic God. So Bill Wilson, I wanted the main man that wrote the book. So he was my higher power. And after about 9 months, the old timers came and says, "Mary, this book is about finding God. It's about finding a power greater than yourself." I said, 3 o'clock in the morning in sobriety, you need a God of your own understanding. So I went on this search for God, for another God. And the messenger comes in various shapes and sizes. I was at this Alano Club in Edmonton, and there was this old gal telling her story. And she was the most spiritual woman I had heard. She had about 20 years sobriety. She was saying things like, "As a drunken woman, I never went in bed with an ugly man, but I sure woke up with a few." She says, "But I don't do it anymore. I don't do it anymore because I am a lady in Alcoholics Anonymous." And I went up to her afterwards and I said, "Who is this God you have? I'm looking for a God." She says, "Mary, my God's called Harold." I said, "Harold?" I was expecting something like Zeus or, you know, something grand. She says, "Well, You know that prayer, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. She was pulling my leg too. But it's okay. You know, today I have a God who is the most constant thing in my life. I know that without God, I'm really nothing. I know without Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that my God brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous so that I could find my God. And I am forever, ever in awe of the fact. You see, Alcoholics Anonymous could only have started in the United States of America. God had to pick two people there. Because of religious bigotry in Europe and other places in the world, a God of my understanding is not allowed. And the other thing that amazes me is that Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob came from Vermont. You know, coincidence is God's way of staying anonymous. And it's almost like every now and then he'll give us these little coincidences like jokes. What are the chances of that, these two men coming together like that? It's an amazing thing. This is a miraculous thing, and I'm so happy to be a part of it. When I was just about a year sober, I got a call from Jamaica to say that my eldest boy would be moving to Canada for 1 year, going to school. And I decided I wanted to be near him. So I called Intergroup in Toronto, and had two people meet my plane. I moved to Toronto. I went into the YWCA. I got a job and got a little apartment and was able to see my boy for a year. And we were able to do a little healing. I got very active in AA. I've always been active in AA in Toronto. Got myself a good sponsor. And I was becoming self-supporting through my own contributions. So after my boy went back to Jamaica, I'm 2 years sober. No, Ernie said I could have a relationship at 2 years. And I'm feeling good. I've got my AA eyes. And one day I go to a meeting on a Sunday morning, and I look down the table and I see him. And he's looking back at me with the same eyes. You think the light in the eyes is spirituality, but sometimes it's psychosis. And I got an antenna. And what happened is, I'm just as sick as he is. Because if I wasn't, he wouldn't be attracted to me. And if he wasn't as sick as me, I wouldn't be attracted to him. But what happened is, I'm 2 years sober. I think I know it all. I can quote Bill Wilson at the drop of a hat. I'm at a meeting every night. I know what I'm doing here. He's 5 years sober. He's a good AA member. And we think that this is made in heaven. My sponsor said to me, "You are an emotional retard. Do not get married." Okay. That's my jug, Charles. So we went to Florida. We eloped. And got married and came back. And what happened, what happened before we actually decided to get married is that him and I, we fell in love with that Velcro aspect. And we still went to a lot of meetings, but we had stopped working on our own personality change and working on each other. And what happened is we'd go to meetings just to see each other. And we'd both have on our peacock feathers. And we'd strut our stuff at the meeting. And somebody would ask me to read how it works, and my eyes would flit across a crowded room at him. And I just knew that God was giving me my reward, and we were going to wander off under the circle and the triangle into the sunset. And it was beautiful. But what happened in the close intimacy of marriage is that one by one, the peacock feathers started dropping off. And in the end, all you had was the same two old turkeys sitting standing. And that's what happened when you don't have the required personality change as promised in Appendix 2 of the Big Book. I loved John and he loved me as much as we knew how. But we were both very sick still. Some of us it takes longer than others. You know, I needed a lot of work and so did John. At 5 years sobriety I had to leave that marriage and I checked out because we were psychologically abusing each other. And I left that marriage and everything in that home and I went to live at the YWCA. I had nothing at 5 years. And that's how it had to be for me. And I surrendered to the God of my understanding one more time. I said, God, give me what I need and take away what I don't. And that is a prayer that I always say. Because I don't always know what's good for me. I think I do. Thank you, my God, for all that you have given me, for all that you have taken away, and for all that you have left me. I love you, God, and without you I am truly nothing. Show me the way, God. Show me the way. How do I do that now? How do I know that God's will is going to come in my life? I'm living at the YWCA. I have nothing. I've left everything in the home. I get a call and I get a little job. And I'm going to do that job. And then eventually I get a call and somebody wants me to do a better job. And I get more money. Then I may believe what move out the YWCA. It's the acceptance that our reader read for us. It is the acceptance under any conditions. Can you stay sober? Can you accept what you're getting in your life and accept Him as God's lessons for you? I did. I got moved out the Y, got a little apartment. And then in 1990, I got a call. Said my two sons had acted up. They'd left their father's house and were living with their old grandmother. And I decided to go back to Kingston, Jamaica. And my sponsor said, go back to Jamaica. You can work down there. Make amends to the island. And I went back to Jamaica and I lived with my old ex-mother-in-law. Their grandmother. And I was able to be with my boys for a little while. And eventually one left and went to the States and one left and went to Europe. I got a wonderful job. I was writing for the newspaper, the Daily Gleaner, down there. And also I was working with the poor. And I was very active in Alcoholics Anonymous in Jamaica. And I did that for 2 years. And then I came back. And this is what I want to share with you. I was talking to Ken about it last night. And he gave me a new angle to look at this thing. Be careful when you ask for God's will. What happened to me was I got back from Jamaica in 1992 and my husband, whom I'd left in Canada, wanted me to come and sign a separation agreement. But I didn't want to do that. I wasn't ready to go and face up to these types of responsibilities. I was still doing it half measures and thinking I will get half measure results. You ever tried that? Doesn't work. Half measures avail us nothing. So I was there in British Columbia. And he was in Toronto, and I said, I wonder what I can do here. Maybe I should go back to Jamaica. Maybe I should go to Florida. Maybe, maybe. So one night, this old-timer and me took a drive to the lake. Milt was emphysemic, and he was sitting in his car. And I get out and say, I'm going to run around the lake. I said, God, give me a sign. What should I do? Should I stay in BC? Should I go to Florida? Should I go to Jamaica? What should I do? And I'm running around this lake and all of a sudden I feel something in my ankle. And I think, is that a snake bite? Or maybe it's a BB gun. Ken says he loves how my mind works. It has to be hostile forces attacking here. And I limp over to the car, because I hadn't fallen or anything. And Milt said to me, did you stand in something? I said, I don't know, Milt. I said, but my foot's very painful. Please take me to the doctor. Anyway, he drove me to the emergency hospital in Vancouver. and they x-rayed and my Achilles tendon had severed. Severed, which is very unusual. I mean, the person, the doctor who was looking after me said to me, in Europe we used to hang people up by their ankles. This is most unusual. So I was put in crutches and I had a cast on for 6 months. What do you think God wanted me to do? Stay right there. And some people came and say, God wouldn't break your Achilles tendon. I said, maybe not yours. Maybe not yours. If every day I am asking God for the third step, seventh step, 11th step, if every day I am asking God for God's will for me, I'm going to get it. You don't want it? Don't ask. God will get my attention any way he can. And you know, about a week after I had that cast put on, they came and asked me to start up a project for Skid Row women. Putting them in and re-educating them, getting them off of skids. And I did it on one leg and they helped me. Then eventually I went back to Toronto, signed a separation agreement. And this is, I will say to you, a relationship is over when it's over. On the 1st of March 1993, I signed a separation agreement with my husband that I'd married in AA. I moved downstairs in the same building as he was. And he told me he was going to go and see his brother, and then on the 11th or 12th of March, we'd get together and fix out the money. And I phoned him on the 10th of March, and there was no reply, and I got that intuitive thought. It said, something's wrong with John. On the 11th of March, I went upstairs and took one of my sons, and I still had a key, because him and me were friends now. And I put the key in the door, and the door was bolted on the inside. And I had the door kicked down, and John was lying by the side of his bed. He'd had a massive stroke. He was lying on parquet floor. It was March. The wind was coming in. And according to the doctors, he'd been lying there for 2 nights and 3 days. If I hadn't gone in, he would have been dead in 8 hours. And I don't know how I went in there. But when I saw him lying there, I have never felt such empathy and compassion for a man. And I knew that if he lived, then this was God's will for me, to teach me a spiritual dimension of love that I had never known. And John was in hospital for 2 years, and then he came home, and he had enormous brain damage. He couldn't speak spontaneous words. He could just repeat parrot fashion. He had paralysis. And I looked after him for 3 years. And it was a wonderful thing, because I think you get amends to do. See, I hadn't been there for my children when they were growing up. My mother and father died not even knowing if I was sober. And I have a chance to make amends to this man for those who are now dead. And I did it willingly, and it was wonderful for me. And last year, he had to go into chronic care. And I was telling another little story. You know, John couldn't speak spontaneously, but there was only two words that he never lost. And that is, take a journey. Do you understand what I mean? You know, it's the F word and then off. Take a journey, you know. I say, take a journey. Well, what happened is, I used to I'd drive him down to Florida every year. And I was driving back from Florida, and we were going through Georgia. Anybody here from Georgia? Are you in a police? No. Just joking. So anyway, we're driving through Georgia, and John wants to go to the little boy's room, and I start speeding. Because I want to get him to some place I can stop. And I hear the police siren and the policeman comes. And he says, you were doing 120 and an 80. I said, well, it's my husband, you see. He needs to go. And I started describing my husband's condition. So he goes over to looking at my husband and rolls down the window. My husband says, F off. And there's this, he's a big policeman. He said, I thought you said he couldn't speak spontaneously. I said, he can't. I said, that's the only words he can say. So I said, if you don't believe me, you can phone the hospital in Toronto, because I'm getting worried now. I'm in foreign territory. And he wouldn't take a check. So anyway, he asked me if I would turn around and drive back to the police station, and I did. I drove back to the police station, and there's an ATM machine conveniently located next to the police station. He says to me when I was leaving, he says, what is that thing your husband has again? I said, global aphasia. And he says, all right. And my husband just went, you know, because he's got one good hand, you know. And I thought, that's that alcoholic in him, you know. So that was the amends with John. The amends with my children have been ongoing. It was a very, very difficult thing to do. How do you do it? Oh, what I had to do was I had to sit down with my boys and tell them. You see, I used to tell my children when they woke up in the morning that the things they saw the night before were not real. I used to tell my children that they were dreaming. I made my children question their reality. So I had to sit down with my children and tell them that everything they ever saw was real. And that I didn't mean to do it because I was an alcoholic. And it took a lot of work. And it took getting through a lot of anger. And then when they were both in their 20s, they came back to me. And we lived for 2 years together in an apartment. And then they left and did their thing. And 2 years ago, my eldest son got married in British Columbia. And the hall that he chose to get married was a hall where I had spoken at an AA meeting earlier that year, and he didn't know that. And his father flew up from Jamaica, and him and me walked my son down the aisle. And this is a man that 20 years ago I had hired 2 gunmen to shoot. And he didn't know that. And he has his wife, and I'd had her hanging out a balcony once, and we're all sitting, and AA has given me dignity and an ability to be with these people and have no resentment or anger in my heart because I've done my amends. That's an amazing thing. Last year, my youngest son got married in Toronto. My son, who was born in Jamaica, got married in a kilt in a Ukrainian church. That's my boy. And he danced with me to a tune called Mama. And my boys know that I have been in the gutter. And sometimes my sons will call and they will say to me, Mom, whenever we are down, we just think about where you have come from. And we have hope. Because sometimes those boys would expect me to come down and see them at Christmas, and they'd get a call that I was in a mental institution one more time. There is no road here from where I'm coming from. I owe Alcoholics Anonymous my life. Alcoholics Anonymous is my dedication and my love. This is not an easy program. We say it's easy, but it is difficult. Because there is an ancient enemy that will come into us many times, and Bill Wilson called it an ancient enemy, and it is called rationalization. And we are the greatest rationalizers in the world. And we can do more damage sober than we ever did drunk. Because when we're sober, we're conscious. And there's a lot of planning and plotting can go in. The 12th step of alcoholics says that we will practice these principles in all our affairs. And we cannot transmit what we do not have. So we have to have a spiritual awakening through working the 12 steps and get a change of personality. And then the change of personality will enable us to go and do that which we would never do before, because we were too selfish, self-centered, and full of self-will run riot. I've had so many adventures in my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I am so grateful for everything I've ever been allowed to do. When people call me and ask me to do service, I thank them, because they are giving me the opportunity to be of service. And also, the things that the power that can go on in Alcoholics Anonymous too is so wrong. The power and the blackballing and the sex that go on in Alcoholics Anonymous is so wrong. This is a fellowship of love. We don't have any leaders here. We're all the same. We're all people who are under the circle and the triangle and who are trying to keep this movement together. A thing since 1935, it's not long ago, prior to 1935, chronic alcoholics were doomed to die. And here we have been given this. Resentment and anger, those are the things that will come up and eventually destroy us within the groups. I hope they don't. I will finish. I'm never going to be perfect, but I'm going to keep trying. That's what it tells me. It just tells me to keep trying. Bill Wilson said once that if we try something and we fail, we thank God for the lesson and we try again. If we try and we win, we thank God and we share it. And I think that's what it's all about. I was watching a program on CNN a couple of years ago, and I'll just finish with this. And these two doctors came out and they said, we're going to penetrate the alcoholic mind. And I'm sitting there and I'm saying, don't go unless you have to. It's scary stuff. So anyway, they were going to, you know, cut up cadavers and look at the brains and do test studies and everything that they ever do with alcoholics, trying to understand. They'll never understand it, but they keep trying to understand it. So I kind of jumped forward, and these two alcoholics came out now, and they were going to give their findings. And this is like 2 years ago. Are you ready for this? There is essentially two findings. One, the alcoholic brain is structurally different to the normal brain. No kidding. If they drank what we drank, their brain would be structurally different. Finding number two, alcoholism is a mystery. Bill Wilson said one is that Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of utter simplicity encased in a mystery. And that's what we have. We suffer from alcoholism, not alcoholism. And by keep coming, we will not change anything. I don't want anything to change. I don't want our Father to change. I don't want a female God. I don't want anything to change in this program. I want it to stay exactly the way it is. And I hope it will be here for my grandchildren. And it has given me everything I have today. And I remember that on a daily basis. And anything I am asked to do for Alcoholics Anonymous, I will do it. Because without Alcoholics Anonymous, I have nothing. Nothing. Thank you so much, Charles, and the committee, and all of you. I've always wanted to come to the Carolinas. I think you're my kind of people, you know. I think you're my kind of people. I want to thank you for your graciousness and for having me. And I'll finish with what Bill Wilson said. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a success story. Rather, it is the chronicle of our colossal human failure, turned to usefulness by the divine alchemy of a loving God. And thank you.